Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Matt Alagaya. On the show today, we'll be going from the Game of Thrones land of Westeros to the stage door of the West End, as we talk TV and books with Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, and writer and critic Mark Mason. Plus, we'll meet the editor of a new collection of short stories and essays that try to get their heads around the idea of disorientation. And we'll have this week's global countdown, of course. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review. Alice and Mark, hello. Welcome to the show. Mark, we'll come to your book choices a little later on, but first we're going to start things off with TV. Alice, as many of our seasoned listeners will know, we're already well into the penultimate season of Game of Thrones here. How has this series fared so far?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because it definitely took a little while to warm up. But on Sunday night in the US and Monday night here, we reached possibly the greatest episode of Game of Thrones ever shown on TV.
Wow. Okay, you have to explain why. Why was it?
Well, I'm not going to spoiler it for anyone, but you don't need to know much about Game of Thrones to know that there are dragons involved. And we're nearing the end of the series, as you say, end of the whole show. And so all of the different power players from different parts of the fantasy land it's set in are reaching their conclusion by battling each other, and dragons were very much involved.
Okay, so this is a very action-packed end of the season, we can say that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, and I mean, this has a bigger budget than pretty much any show ever made. I mean, actors are earning up to £2 million an episode here. Can you see the money being spent?
Yeah, you can really see it ramping up. I mean, the interesting thing is that because it's so progressive that you don't actually notice until you go back and watch older episodes, and they definitely look a bit more dowdy, a bit less shiny. I mean, for instance, in the scene I was just referring to, I think the stunt director said that they used every single stuntman in the UK for this episode. Yeah, it's just the scale of it is ridiculous. Even he's like, HBO doubled their budget since the first episode.
That's incredible. I mean, it's interesting. We've seen this program, you know, obviously become hugely, hugely popular. Do you think it's going to continue from strength to strength for the rest of its tenure? I mean, or is it starting to flag, I guess, as we approach the end? You seem to feel that it's really going from strength to strength.
I mean, there's just so much pressure because obviously everyone wants a big climax. There's a lot of fan theories. You've got George R. R. Martin's books. That's the series that the show was adapted from. And actually, the show has outpaced the books. So in a way, they're kind of creating their own destiny. They've got to get the ending right. And that's kind of a doomed mission because they're never going to please everybody.
Well, because that's interesting that they stopped following the books from season 5, if I'm right.
Around then, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Can you tell that they are now writing their own scripts, or is it pretty consistent the way that they write the series?
I mean, I've not read the books. I mean, I'm going to put my hands up and say I'm not a huge fantasy nerd. This is sort of this is an exception to my usual appetites, but there are definitely some elements of the plot which the kind of fans discussion around the show is saying, oh, this would never happen if George R. R. Martin was involved. But there are some things which are definitely more gory or a little bit more provocative, but there's a hell of a lot more that's really scaled back in comparison to the nastiness that goes on in the books.
I see. I feel quite sorry for George R. R. Martin as well, because he's trying to finish these books and they're sort of going to 1,000 pages now, and he's watching all of these series come and go. Mark, I hear you're not a massive fan of the series Game of Thrones.
Well, I want to be, and it's intriguing when you were saying you're not normally a fantasy nerd, that I'm not either. But then a few years ago, I didn't think I was into science fiction. I'd always been quite snobbish about science fiction. And then I had to review a book about Philip K. Dick, the most famous science fiction author ever. And it was a story of some nerds, very clever people who can build robots and things, building a robot that would be as like Philip K. Dick as possible. And so then I thought, well, I'll go and read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Because having said I'm not into science fiction, I loved Blade Runner. So there's always these illogicalities there. And I want to like fantasy, and I've heard I've been intrigued, your thoughts on this, political writers saying that you can see a lot of, you know, power struggles, and they always say that about The Godfather as well, that you can see every political power struggle that's being played out in the Tory Party, Labour Party, America, wherever it is, in Game of Thrones. Can you see that sort of thing?
I think it's the relationships between them which keep people watching. It's the deviousness. It's who's going to stab who in the back. Yeah. And yes, it's fantasy. Yeah, there are dragons and there's ludicrous potions and there's reanimated corpses. But I'd say that occupies kind of 4% of the show, which is mostly, it's like any other monastic period drama. It's who's beating who, who's stabbing who, who's having sex with who.
It's always a story. There's only seven stories or whatever number you hear of that theory that, yeah, they always appeal to something in us, even if it's a purple dragon that doesn't exist in the universe a billion whatever years away. Then, you know, as you say, it has to appeal. I should give it more of a go.
Maybe, yeah.
The dragons aren't purple, I'm afraid.
Yeah. See? I told you I wasn't a nerd.
Your father and brothers are gone, yet here you stand. Last best hope against the coming storm.
If we don't put aside our enmities and band together, we will die. And then it doesn't matter whose skeleton sits on the Iron Throne.
You mentioned there's reanimated corpses and there are dragons, obviously. One of the much talked about things about this season has been a slightly cringeworthy cameo by Ed Sheeran.
Oh, God, yeah.
What do you think? What did you make of that? I mean, do you think the show lost a bit of credibility there?
The thing is, what was really interesting is I was sort of delving around on Reddit and the fan forums after that. And for the vast majority of American reviewers, they had no idea Ed Sheeran was even in it because he's huge in the UK, obviously, and he's got significant US impact on the airwaves, but he's not a particularly recognisable person. And what I love about what the director said about it is that, and I don't think he meant this as an insult, but he was like, Ed Sheeran just looked the part, which is, I mean, he kind of looks like this slightly scruffy medieval squire, which I'm just going to leave that there.
He's certainly got the scruffy. You can't argue
that he's got the scruffy. Yeah, yeah. Bit of a beard as well.
He rode to a woman's side, for she was a secret treasure. She was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are.
It's a pretty song. I've never heard it before.
It's a new one.
Game of Thrones is showing on HBO at 2100 Eastern Standard Time on Sunday nights in the US and simultaneously plays on Sky Atlantic in the UK if you're willing to stay up until 2 a.m. Don't worry, it repeats at the more sociable time of 1900 on a Monday evening. Sticking with HBO, we now tune in to Insecure. This TV series was critically acclaimed when it started last year and has just begun its second season. Alice, first of all, fill us in on what this show is about and what happened in series one.
Well, it's not a big one on plot, especially in comparison to Game of Thrones. Insecure is a creation by a writer and original web series creator called Issa Rae, and she plays a character called Issa, who I think is sort of loosely autobiographical. And we follow Issa, and she's a sort of a normal black young woman who works in a not-for-profit startup and has a relationship and has best friends and goes about her business. It's really as simple as that. People will wrongly, I believe, call it, you know, the black equivalent of Girls, which is Lena Dunham's series for HBO. But it's really a kind of unfolding drama about what it's like to be a young black woman who doesn't fit into the stereotypes usually shown on television.
And so in a way, can you see, I guess, do these characters feel different? Are they being handled differently to other portrayals of black people in other shows that you've seen? I mean, can you see that this has been written by a young black woman?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Rae said that she wasn't making this show particularly for anyone other than her friends and her family. She grew up watching a lot of things like Girlfriends, and a lot of kind of TV aimed at black audiences in the 90s, which has sort of dripped out of programming over the last couple of decades. And yes, it is different. You know, I think she said something along the lines of that she wanted to create a space for the basic black person to be shown on TV, a normal, not cool, not particularly sassy, not stereotyped person on TV. And it's really refreshing for that.
Absolutely. I mean, the black stereotype is generally either the best friend or the one person in the flat who's black. And they tend to, as you say, be stereotyped in that way.
Mm.
Do you think this might pave the way then, or has it already paved the way, I guess, for more series like this to be made in the States?
I mean, you'd really hope so. I think it's remarkable in both a good and a bad way that it's taken HBO this long to create a show with a black woman at the helm. This is the first of its nature for a huge juggernaut network in the US. And I think the problem is more endemic than just getting one show in. There's not that many people of colour in writers' rooms. There's not that many people of colour commissioning TV series. Yes, it's absolutely paved away, but there's a lot more than just getting one series on.
And in terms of genre, I mean, is this an out-and-out comedy, or do you think it's more in that space? I mean, you mentioned Girls there. I mean, there's a lot of other shows on at the moment. Master of None seems to come to mind. That space kind of between drama and comedy, so it's not sort of laugh out loud every other minute. Where is it? Is it in that sort of out-and-out
comedy? It is in that space, yeah. It's undeniably funny. One of the shticks of the main character is that she's a terrible rapper. She's a terrible amateur rapper, and she'll rap to herself in the toilet. And it's called Insecure because she is an insecure, awkward, socially awkward person. So that is funny, but I think in the way of these comedies, as the series progress, they do become darker, they do become more serious. We saw that with Girls, we're seeing that with Master of None. And at the end of season one, Issa does go through a breakup, and now we're seeing her deal with that fallout in season two. So it's definitely solidly in the middle there.
Okay, and just quickly, what have we seen at the beginning of season two? I mean, no spoilers, but has a bit of time elapsed between the series?
There's enough time elapsed for her to get involved with literally every dating app out there.
It's only just listening to you talk like that. When I was growing up, The Cosby Show was the biggest thing in world TV. The whole of Britain and America, The Cosby Show was the biggest show for the best part of a decade. And then it went away, and there's not been anything like that since. It's incredible that, looking back on it now, of course, growing up, you don't think of it like this. You didn't notice that Bill Cosby was black. You just noticed he was funny. And OK, there's problems with what's happened in his private life since. But looking back on that as a TV success then, it's incredible. There's been nothing like that since.
Yeah, it was much more prevalent in the 90s, you know, as well. Yeah. As then, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air,
yeah,
Sister. Yeah. There were lots of them. Yeah. And watched universally across the Atlantic.
Yeah. And we've got a clip here. So let's listen to a clip of the trailer for season two.
Gross.
Was she playing me the whole time we were together?
Honestly, I ain't all on Issa.
I betrayed his trust, and I have to give him space to forgive me.
You know what that is? Growth.
You're a big girl. Got them big girl panties.
I'm one of the best lawyers they have. I can't just roll up to the partners like, hey guys, I accidentally noticed that y'all paid me less than this white guy.
That's why I make sure my white clients get less on their tax returns.
It's reparations. Real talk, don't tell nobody, because I'm going to go to full jail.
Insecure is showing on HBO now every Sunday at 10:30 p.m. and just started on Sky Atlantic, where it's shown every Thursday at 10:35. That's it for TV this week. Thanks very much for your picks, Alice. Now, Mark Mason, let's talk non-fiction and open up a couple of titles that have piqued your interest recently. The first of which is called Get Me the Urgent Biscuits, an assistant's adventures in Theatreland. What's this one all about?
It's about an assistant who comes to London, a girl who comes to London at the age of 18 in 1984. And she, at that point, she's called Jane Slight. And then she ends up working very quickly for a theatre producer called Thelma Holt, who christens her Sweet Pea, just as an affectionate name. And it becomes so common a name for it that she then changes it changes it on her passport and driving license. So now she's Sweet Pea Slight. And it's the story of what happened over almost the next 20 years when she was working as an assistant. And it's one of those things that you think it could be a nice little flippant, but with some stories about showbiz personalities or theatre personalities of the time. And there is that. There's great stuff. Helen Mirren turns out to be a hero. As soon as I saw the name Helen Mirren, I thought, I like her. Please don't let it be a horrible story. And it's a lovely story that, first of all, Sweet Pea wants to be an actress herself, and she writes a fan letter to Helen Mirren, who then, really nice, sends back the letter just saying it's, you know, best of luck and all that sort of stuff, but also includes a £20 note for Sweet Pea and a £20 note for her friend, saying, I can remember what it's like to be new in London and not have any money. This is to go and have some fun with. There's all that sort of stuff, but also it's a much more weighty book than that. There's a much more of a story, which is Sweet Pea coming to London to use that horrible phrase that hippies always used to use, to find herself. And, you know, I was not from London and came to live in London at pretty much the same age. And so it chimed with me, and most of the people I know in London are like that. Therefore, I don't know about you. Are you from London originally? Or?
I grew up in London, but I know lots and lots of friends who you know, moved here after university.
How about you, Alice? Is that?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm terribly home county. So, yeah,
there we go.
No, I came here. I was 22, 23, and exactly the same thing, like living on £50 a week, etc.
Yeah. And that's just, what do you want to do with your life? Well, you know you don't fit in at home. And in Sweet Pea's case, it was Dorset. In my case, it was the Midlands. And I was thinking, there's lots of similarities here. You just don't know what you're going to do. And she ends up very quickly working in the theatre. And her relationship with Thelma is fascinating.
Who is Thelma? I mean, she's a well-known name for some people.
Yeah, she's a force of nature in theatre. Or she was back then. She was a theatre producer. She was one of those larger-than-life characters. There's lots of little descriptions from everybody that comes into the book that knows Thelma. One of them says she talked to a swing bin if it would listen. And she has got a dishwasher, which she's had for, I think, 30 years, but she's never worked out how to work the dishwasher. So she uses it to store her wine in. And she keeps coming up with phrases like, it's all going terribly wrong. And she says about one production where all the actors have been misbehaving and it's a nightmare. She goes, we're living in a fucking Joe Orton play, darlings. So she's a very vivid character. Right. So you can imagine a sitcom about Thelma Holt.
Do you see a bit more depth than just those kind of anecdotes here? I mean, do we see a complex character emerge about Thelma, who I imagine is the main character, really?
Well, she is. But the real complexity comes in, not so much just in her, but in the relationship between the two of them. And there's a very mother-daughter thing there. I mean, the ages fit. And Sweet Pea's just needs mothering, needs looking after. And Sweet and Thelma is always fighting battles for her and looking after her. And then there's also the element, as it goes on and on, of you sense, and this is brilliantly written, Sweet Pea never actually says it in these words, but you just get this sense developing of it being a bit oppressive in the end, that we all have to leave our parents in the end. We all have to grow up and go out and find our way in the world. And that maybe Thelma helped Sweet Pea discover who she was. And there's a brilliant thing of pretending to be other people. You find out who you are by copying other people when you come to London. And literally she's doing it. She's very quickly given the job of the playwright, Ray Cooney. She has to answer his fan letters, and she can do Ray Cooney's signature and answer his fan letters in his style so well that in the end Thelma can't tell the real ones from the ones Sweet Pea's done. And also she gets to use Thelma's credit card. She learns to do Thelma's signature so she can use the credit card. There's that thing of finding who you are by copying other people and finding what fits and doesn't. But then also that thing of you have to break away in the end. And she says, in the end, I had to decide I wasn't going to work for Thelma anymore. And she walks away. And it's really well. And it's a really fascinating story of someone coming, finding out who they are, and then having to move on.
And is that kind of intoxicating atmosphere as well, of being surrounded by celebrities and all these very, very eccentric people? Does that become a bit, I don't know, claustrophobic by the end? Or do you think that's still, I don't know, she still enjoyed it even after 20 years?
Yeah, I think certainly it wears off the novelty of just being around these famous people. And she knows who the femme and she knows who she wants to spend time with and who she wants to get away from. But right at the beginning, there's a story of Robert Maxwell being involved with Thelma, not with Sweet Pea. This was before Sweet Pea was in London, but she tells the story. Robert Maxwell once stuck his head round the door. He was involved in some organisation that Thelma was to do with. And Robert Maxwell sticks his hand around the door. His first words to Thelma are, I'm Robert Maxwell. There are three things you should know about me. I don't drink, I don't gamble, and I don't sleep with women. And Thelma Holt says, that's splendid. We've got at least two things in common. So there's all those sort of stuff. But then, like I say, it moves away from just being that to the characters of the two of them and how they develop and interact and what Sweet Pea does about it.
Does it feel like she's telling a story about a theatre industry kind of gone by? Is there a sense of nostalgia there? Or do you think things are still like that now on the West End?
I think they're all like that. They'll always be like that. Actors will always, you know, I got friends who are actors and they wouldn't mind me saying this. There are two sorts of actors, ones who get on and can do the job and they'll have a moan, but they won't be, you know, flaky about it. And there's a story very early on when Sweet Pea still thinks she wants to be an actress herself. She asks an actor any advice and he says, yeah, you just need a skin like a rhinoceros. And so there are actors around like that, and they're the ones who keep getting work, who will turn up. Towards the end, there's one actor who's so... He must have been good because they kept indulging him. But in his contract, it was a clause that his dog had to be looked after when they went on tour and that a room had to be found for his dog in the hotel. His dog was completely imaginary. But just to indulge him, they kept putting that in the contract, saying, yes, yes, we'll sort that out for you. So he must have been good for them to put up with that.
Amazing. Get Me the Urgent Biscuits, An Assistant's Adventures in Theatreland by Sweet Pea Slight is out now, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. We now turn to an upcoming book, The Story of Colour by Gary Evans. This talks about different colours through the cultural spectrum, from the White House to pink for girls and blue for boys. Where do these connotations come from and why do we associate certain colours with certain things? Mark, this feels like the kind of book you'd instantly love, sort of packed full of surprising facts and anecdotes. Does Evans provide many answers to those questions?
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And stuff you weren't expecting. The best answer, I think, is the one to the question that hadn't even occurred to you. You know, that you just go, oh, wow, yeah. Like The White, when he's done it, it's beautiful. The book looks fantastic, the way it's set out. And, it's a nice big format and it's organised by chapter. So it goes through the spectrum.
Blue. So there's a whole chapter on white.
And so all the stories that come around from the different colours. For instance, in White, there is the story, I didn't know this, that the US Air Force's nuclear bombers are painted white because as and when, they haven't done it since the Second World War, but as and when they drop the nuclear bomb, the nuclear, whatever, the thermal radiation that comes off it, they'll still be near enough for that to be a problem, and the white will help reflect some of that. So I was thinking, if you were a pilot getting in to fly that, and that colour white would be a reminder of how close you're going to be to it, even having dropped the bomb and flown off. But then also going back into history, ancient Greeks, and the Romans for that matter, whenever you see a building that copies one of their buildings, you know, like the British Library in London or something, where there's big columns and it's all white and it's antique, you know, antiquity and classic style, that's completely wrong. They actually had coloured buildings. They painted their buildings really bright colours. The only reason we think they're white is that by the time we found them, the paint had worn off.
Right.
And I don't know how there's this evidence they found that the buildings would have been painted a bright colour. So, you know, 2,000 years has been a big mistake.
And is there, I mean, you've obviously said there's history here and there's a lot of sort of delving through culture. Is there also science here? I mean, do we find out about the science of colour as well?
Yeah, there's a bit at the beginning before it goes into the specific colours. There's a general bit about the rods, and don't ask me to explain it too closely, but...
rods and cones.
Rods and cones, yes. And also about colour blindness. I'd never known... And I don't think there's a specific explanation for why this is, but there is a gender bias in colour blindness. Do you know about this?
Yeah, it's quite unusual to find a colour blind woman.
Yeah, it's much more common, isn't it?
0.5% of British women, 8% of British men.
8%, that's really high.
It is really common, actually, yeah.
And that 8% did surprise me. And the only thing I knew about colour blindness before this is being a snooker nerd. I may not be a fantasy nerd, but I'm a snooker nerd. In the rules of snooker, the only time the player is allowed to ask the referee for help is if he suffers from colour blindness. And there are a couple of them. Peter Ebdon, a snooker player, and usually, of course, it's the red and the brown ball, will get them mixed up, and he'll sometimes stop and ask the referee which is which. Because if he hits the wrong one, it'll be a foul shot. So the stuff like that, there's a bit of nature in there. The flamingos are only pink because of all the seafood they eat. it's one of those things, it's almost childish. You know, if a kid was going to design the universe, it would, yeah, well, the flamingos are pink because they eat lots of pink food. But that's the truth. Yeah.
Interesting. And I mentioned in the introduction that we associate pink with girls sometimes and blue with boys. Is there a real sort of investigation of why those associations have grown up?
Well, that one specifically, yes. I don't think we know the why, but what's true is that 150 years ago, in fact, I think up to about 100 years ago, it was the other way around. It was pink for boys and girl for blue and blue for girls.
Wow.
Bizarre. My favourite pink thing in the book, before we leave pink, is there was a guy in charge of an American jail a few years ago who, when at the end of the sentences, all the inmates, as they were released, were stealing the prison underwear that they'd been given. So it's very simple. He just made it pink. He made them wear pink underwear when they're in prison so they wouldn't nick it.
Oh, interesting. And finally, just tell us a little bit about Gary Evans, the author here. I mean, he's written quite a few books. Do you know much about what he's up to?
I don't specifically, not about him, but I know I like this book and I like to check out more of his stuff because he's got the right attitude of, you know, you need a beautiful fact like that, like the pink underwear, to get you interested. But then it can teach you more about the science and the heavier stuff as well.
The Story of Colour by Gary Evans is out on August 17th, published by Michael O'Mara Books. Thanks, Mark, for your book recommendations today. We'll be back with Mark Mason and Alice Vincent in just a moment, but first we're going to hear about another new publication that's launching next week. You may know Some Such Stories, but if you don't, then it's a website and a biannual publication brimming with short stories and essays by some of the brightest emerging writers around. Each publication is themed, and the third edition explores the idea of disorientation, as editor Suze Ulbrich tells Monocle's Holly Fisher.
Some Such Stories is a digital and print magazine. It publishes one piece a week online and then is a biannual print magazine as well. It publishes essays and fiction that are focused on contemporary experiences of anything from like sex, nature, society, politics, mysticism. I guess it's meant to engender curiosity and communication, and the sort of the mood of it can vary from quite hard-hitting reported pieces to things that are very, I'm not going to say whimsical, but quite fun fiction, or really, you know, weird. It gets a bit weird sometimes, which we quite like also.
You do your printed version, and the third edition has just arrived fresh from the printers this week. And you theme each of these printed editions that you do, and this one is disorientation, which I mean, we can kind of see why someone would want to make a journal about disorientation in summer 2017. But how do you come up with the themes that you do for these?
They come from quite a lot of things. I'm also a journalist and I cover quite a few different areas like culture, travel, food, and quite kind of tend to read everything anyway. It's an idea of trying to pull together strands of thought that are already in all these different areas around the world anyway, as well as sort of news, and then kind of write some notes about things that, you know, themes and topics, and then put it all down for a couple of weeks, which I find is essential, and then try to distill something. I was thinking about it while it was just after, sort of about months after Trump's inauguration. So there's already been like quite a lot of upheaval and turmoil. And then I was away also, so I was trying to kind of think that through while being in Mexico, which is somewhere I'd never been before. The way people live out there is so different from us. And I felt a bit like I couldn't quite tell. My preconceptions were a bit messed up, which I really enjoyed actually, because it meant I could look at bigger topics without having the same... the dialogue with myself that I get in the UK, which, and I also hadn't read any UK news, I guess, apart from glimpsing at stuff for about a week. So that was, I kind of wrote a note about disorientation. Then when I got home about 2 weeks later, I kind of got all of that stuff together and it seemed to stick as a theme stemming from, you know, like you were saying, the discombobulation from news events. But also if you look into the future, we've got things like the rise of robot technology. People, you know, how people live is kind of unstable. You don't know what sort of rental, if rentals will exist, or if people will be living in pods, and, you know, mechanization and all these things playing into it, as well as like shifts in identity. People are identifying differently. Communities are fracturing and reforming. So it seemed like all of it could kind of do with a little bit of a look, like it would make for some good writing.
These publications are a real champion of different types of creative writing and emerging writers and just different ways of looking at things. Do you think that that's something that needs to be addressed in today's world of journalism and writing?
I mean, there are. If you look at it globally, there are some wonderful... there are some brilliant things going on around the world. And you do have, I mean, you have Granta, you have M+1, you have, I used to say, like the Berlin Quarterly and Tank do some great sort of writing of this kind. And there are places around, but I think it's more common in the US for people to read things like the New Inquiry or M+1. In the UK, I mean, we've got the White Review, we've got some good stuff, but there's not the space, I think. There's not that much space for people to do writing of this kind, especially not paid for, which I think does need addressing. And especially if you're a fiction writer, and we don't have the MFA structure in this country, and there aren't that many spaces for people who are kind of gearing up to do novels to kind of train and practice their craft and find a little bit of an audience. So, yeah, I mean, there's great stuff out there, but there could definitely be more.
And one of the things that struck me about reading this was, because it's a mixture of fiction and non-fiction, but you don't actually know which ones are fiction and non-fiction. And I wondered if that was something that you'd done on purpose to just let the writing speak for itself without having to think about it within a context.
That's kind of how we've always... I mean, when a lot of the essays we publish are would could be termed creative non-fiction, if you wanted to use that. I kind of used that term a little at the beginning, just trying to like help define what it was, and then realised it is all, everything's creative, it's all kind of useless. I don't think people need telling, really. I think we should get used to kind of having to work these things out for ourselves a little bit more. Not so much in the way that things are true or untrue, but just fact. Fiction does, it is blended in all sorts of writings, like especially in essays, there's a lot of creativity.
Well, let's talk about the design of this, because the topic is disorientation, and that is well reflected in the way that the book is laid out.
Yes.
Half the book's upside down, the other half is the right way up, and then one story starts halfway through and then it suddenly picks up again later on in the book. It took me a while to work out what was happening. Then I realised if you look at the page numbers, you can work it out because they're all jumbled up, but they will navigate you through. Tell us a bit about how you came up with the design for the book.
I mean, this is very much Fraser Muggeridge Studios design. We worked with them on the last issue also, and they're pretty wonderful. They make great works. They do lots of art books and things. And because the writing is, I mean, it's engaging, it's quite... most of the things, and they're thought-provoking, they're dense, so I knew that we couldn't really play around too much with the text, but that you wanted the theme to come through within the design, because we are, it's also playful and it's quite a fun thing to be disoriented a little bit. So I mean, this was Fraser suggested the upside down section pretty much straight away. He's like, what if we just flip? I was like, oh, hang on a minute, because actually it doesn't take away, what you don't want to do is take away from the, you don't want to make it like kind of you know, one of those like games, like quest games, where people have to like flow through a book because you'll ruin the rhythm of the writing also. So it was just a way to bring that sort of that in a really fun way. And I think there's other little tiny sort of bits and pieces through it. But yeah, we just kind of wanted to bring the disorientation into the design without harming the words or the meaning of the words.
Suze Ulbrich there, editor of Some Such Stories. The third edition of the publication will be hitting shop shelves at the end of next week. Head to somesuchstories.co for more information. Now, to end the show, as usual, it's time for our global countdown, where we look at the charts of a specific country. And Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me in the studio now. Faye, where are you taking us this week?
Well, we're going to a very important music market. We're going to Turkey today. And it's a fantastic top five. You're in for a treat because
Alice can't wait.
It's so exciting.
I have to be honest with you. As you know, I can't use a better. All I can say that all the songs have a big fat beat in it. You know, they like to dance. There's no space for ballads, and I think some of you might recognize number one if you think about a decade ago or so.
I'm quite into Turkish dance music as it goes.
Oh, so
yeah,
you would love.
This is just
you
like
love Alice.
So great.
It's a niche one, a niche following.
Shall we start? I'll do a little countdown.
Perfect.
I'm not going to talk too much about number five because I have a feeling he might come back to the list. It's Tarkan.
Wink, wink.
Tarkan is the famous Turkish singer with the song, Kiss Kiss, which was a major hit in the 90s. But as I said, I don't want to talk too much. The song is called Benik Çok Seviyorum, which is Love Me So Much. I did practice my Turkish a little bit, but again, listeners, I'm so sorry if I say anything wrong. Number four, we're talking about dance music. We have Turkish DJ Ozan Doğulu, and he did a partnership with Denet Akalin. She's a former model, she's 45 now. She released a couple of singles, and in the video clip, it's called Kulip, and they're playing beach volleyball. People are having a couple of cocktails. It's a very summery song. I quite like number four. Number three, that's an interesting one. Her name is Alena Tilki. The song is called Sen Olsen Body, which is You Are Alive. And she's only 17. But to be honest, when I saw the video, I was like, oh my God, she looks older. I mean, she has a very powerful voice. And the video clip is a bit like she's the kind of the Turkish Barbie girl in a way.
She sounds like a shoo-in for Eurovision next year.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. There's sad news for Alice because, you know, Turkey left Eurovision. Apparently, they tried
in
to...
In my heart, I'm still hoping they'll come back, though.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they are excellent in it. And and to be honest, for a moment, they created the Turk vision. But I don't think it worked out very well. But who knows? They might come back. And I think she'll be a good one for it. And there's so many views on YouTube as well. It's crazy, the numbers. Number two, we have kind of a young Tarkan. You know, his name is Edis. And the song's called Çok Çok.
Very nice.
Pronunciation,
yeah.
Sorry.
Which like is being in Istanbul then.
Exactly. It's Send Me, the song, which is translating Send Me. Which is, I think, semi-letters of love, something like that. You
okay,
know?
Interesting.
But shall we play number one?
I'd love to hear it, yeah.
That was Yola, guys, by Tarkan. And as you can see, you know, it's a perfect song for the dance floor. And it's interesting because Tarkan has such an amazing career. He's about, again, mid-40s, but he's still number one in the charts. And, I was reading some reviews about his album. Apparently, he is to Turkey what Elvis was to the US. Just so you see how important he is, you know.
So has he been around for 20 years? I mean, did he start in his 20s?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And he's one of the few like major pop acts that doesn't sing in English. So even the song Kiss Kiss, which, we had an English version with Holly Valance.
Dada Goodrum. Oh, yeah. Not confusing my neighbor stars there.
Exactly.
What a mistake to make her.
So, you know, the track was famous because, you know, he kissed in the track like... you know, and something like that. But I think Yola is, it might be the new Kiss Kiss.
Mark, what did you think of that? What did you make of Yola by Tarkan?
Well, I can only go on, I shall credit my assistant in my tastes on music, who's sitting there through the glass, my eight-year-old son, who was moving like I haven't seen him move for a very long time. There was even one or two dabs came into play there. I have to say, that's how impressed he was with it. So I shall refer to him.
Alice, is that going on your list of all-time favourite Turkish dance records?
It's going to go on my 2 a.m. playlist. As, you know, it's going to get everyone moving at that time in the evening.
It's certainly my playlist as well, I have to say. And it's cross-generation, as you just mentioned, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
It's for all ages.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Faye, for your global countdown there. Well, that brings us to the end of today's programme. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I've been Matt Alagaya. To play us out, let's hear a bit more of that number one track from Tarkan. This is Yola. Thanks for listening.